From the Bartlett Center for Advanced Spatial Analysis at UCL, you're listening to The Global Lab. The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist. This episode, we're talking about some of the great subterfuges, the things which you could never imagine could be hidden in plain sight. Alex Mankoo is going to tell us about weapons of mass destruction and how you might find yourself wandering right into a live weapons test of biological or chemical weapons. Max Coulson will discuss his work illuminating mechanisms of control through art and photography. But first, we're going to hear about the master of surveillance, Jeremy Bentham, still hiding in plain sight in University College London. And it's said that if you walk the cloisters of UCL on a dark winter's night, you may still feel his beady eye upon you.
My name's Tim Causer. I'm a senior research associate at the Bentham Project in the Faculty of Law.
So Jeremy Bentham isn't exactly hidden in plain sight, but he is in plain sight, isn't he?
Yes, I think within a few days of starting at UCL, most new students will have encountered this strange figure behind the glass in the box in the corner of the South Cloisters.
So that's not an exaggeration. He's literally in a box with a glass front in the middle of University College London. Why is that?
It's a very good question, one we're often asked. Before he died, Bentham made a couple of wills. The first one was when he was in his 20s, I think, and he was going to leave his body to a Dr. Fordyce, just to leave it to medical science. And Fordyce, just coincidentally, was the father of Maria Sophia Fordyce, who later became Jeremy's sister-in-law when she married his brother Samuel. But later in life, Bentham revised his will, and he left his body to his friend, Dr. Thomas Southwood Smith, and with the provision that that Smith publicly dissect Bentham's corpse in front of an audience, then reassemble the skeleton after having removed the skin, dress it in a body of his clothes, in a suit of his clothes, and sit it on a chair in a sort of representation of how Bentham sat when he was thinking and writing.
That sounds kind of incredible. Was that something anyone else had done before? Is this something that he innovated, or was this the fashion of the times?
As far as I'm aware, this is the only instance from the 1830s, and it's remarkable that it was actually put into practice, into effect rather, because at the time, one of the reasons Bentham wanted his body to be dissected was because he thought he didn't believe there was such a thing as a human soul. The body to him was just this wondrous machine. So on one level, he wanted his body to go to medical science, because at the time, the only other legal way of getting bodies for surgeons was either by the corpses of paupers who died in poor houses and weren't claimed by their family, or the bodies of executed criminals. So anatomization was seen as a sort of an extra punishment beyond actually being hanged. Your immortal soul would be, put at risk and yeah.
So by sort of casting the body to the four winds, you're doing the same thing with the soul. I mean, it seems even today that's an extraordinarily selfless or atheistic act. I mean, how would you characterize it?
Yeah, there are other sort of competing interpretations of the auto-ic, and I suspect a lot of it is Bentham did have a sense of humour. He's sort of seen as this sort of the cold utilitarian calculator, but he can be quite funny and sarcastic, actually. And there's this sense that some suggest he's having a bit of a joke, others suggest it was a lot to do with his ego. He did have quite a big ego. But there's also Bentham long opposed the established church. I think it was in the 1810s, he called for the euthanization of the Church of England, so not employing any more clergymen as they died off. He saw it as a, an inherently corrupt organisation.
And was that a controversial view? Was he in a, I mean, I assume he's in a minority, but was he the only person being that outspoken about the church?
I suspect so. And one of the reasons, and one of the other reasons why, so the auto icon is, can be seen as another branch in that attack on religion, on organised religion, I should say. In that if you died and you wanted to be buried, you had to pay a priest to do it. So by being an auto icon, Bentham and his family and his friends would not have to give any money to the Church of England.
That's amazing. So he's stiffing the CV and trying to cut off its lifeblood.
It does seem this antipathy towards the Church of England began when he was quite young, when he went to Oxford at the age of 12. And he, because to matriculate there, you had to subscribe to the 39 Articles of the Church of England. And Bentham felt sort of forced into it. He didn't really believe in it. But he went through it anyway in order to get his degree.
So he regretted it ever after. So he was studying for a degree at the age of 12?
Yes, yeah, he went to Oxford when he was 12. He was very prodigious and precocious.
Again, that can't have been something that was particularly common.
No, and he had a pretty miserable time of it because he was just so much younger than everyone else.
So how did he come to be displayed in UCL and not on the fourth plinth or somewhere like that?
It's an interesting one. After Smith dissected Bentham and put the auto icon together, and after Bentham wanted his real head to be part of the auto icon, but the preservation process went horribly wrong, and it's hideous. So Smith,
worse than in life.
Yes, you can just about see the likeness, but it's a lot redder now. And
it could have been a wine drinker. You never know.
You can still see the stubble on it, but it's really fragile. If there's a breeze, then bits of the hair fall out. And it's one of these things that's best kept out of the way and occasionally looked at in a photograph, but not seen.
So you've got his skeleton, his real clothes, and not his real head.
No, that was a wax head which Smith commissioned from a French sculptor, and some of Bentham's friends thought it was a remarkable likeness. So we're quite confident that the wax head is a really decent likeness of Bentham, of an elderly Bentham.
How did that end up here at UCL?
So the auto icon, as such, went. Smith kept it in his living room for 18 years.
That's a really long wake.
Yes. And apparently people went round to see it. And they later found it sort of wrapped in a tarpaulin inside the chest cavity of the auto icon.
That's really macabre.
Nobody thought to look in there. It's
probably they didn't want to look in there, did they?
Indeed, I can't see the rationale for undoing Bentham's jacket and having a look inside, really.
Some people think Bentham was one of the founding fathers, if that's the right word, of UCL, but that's not quite correct, is it?
No, he wasn't. There is a little plaque on the auto icon that says Bentham is one of the founders of UCL, but that's not true. And in the main library, there's a painting which shows Bentham looking at the plans for UCL as it's being constructed, but that's just a fiction. He did make a subscription to the building of the college for £100, but he wasn't a founder by any means. And we can say he was the sort of spiritual founder, and his ideas about education, the idea that education should be open to all, regardless of sex and creed, did influence those who did found UCL. So it's his disciples who had the impact in this instance. So yeah, Bentham wasn't a founder of the college at all.
So for over 100 years, I guess, people in UCL have been walking past and staring at Jeremy Bentham. And for a while, he was actually staring back, wasn't he? Would you like to tell us about the Panopticam project?
Yes. The Panopticam was first spoken about maybe three or four years ago. And it took a while to get it up and running, but it's sort of it's a small project. It's a collaboration. It's mainly run by the CASA, the Centre for Digital Humanities and Museums, and we're just sort of the Bentham Project sort of tacked on and helping out. But it's the Panopticam is essentially a 3D printed webcam which sits on top of the Auto Icons box. And sort of records what's happening in the cloisters, and it films a stopgap video which was uploaded to YouTube at the end of the day, so you could see what was happening in front of the Auto Icon as the day progressed, and it automatically tweeted a photograph at 1 minute past the hour every hour during the working day, and a lot of the time sort of during term time it's just photographs of an empty floor. So it's like the existential view of Bentham's Bentham's death. I was going to say life, but his death. So it's sort of it's a bit jokey, really, in the idea that Bentham is watching you, and Bentham was when he envisaged this panoptic in prison, which is one of the dominating things of his life. He was going to be the inspector, so he that never came to fruition.
So this is a sort of like a technological pun on this idea of the panopticon prison. Maybe we could to explain what that is, because I know there's sort of various explanations floating around as to what that prison was, and whether it's a metaphor or a real building, and you're probably the best person to tell us which it is.
I can try. The panopticon. It was actually an idea. The key feature of the panopticon is what Bentham called the central inspection principle, and it was something that his younger brother Samuel came up with when Samuel was working in Russia for Prince Potemkin and Catherine the Great, and he was trying to come up with a way of supervising the overseers of unskilled workers. So he came up with this idea of where he could sit in the middle of a building and keep his eye on the overseers who were keeping an eye on the unskilled workers and training them.
So just making sure that they're doing their job in managing their teams or whatever?
Yeah, rather than messing about and drinking and faffing about and otherwise. So Jeremy then adapted this. He saw it, Bentham's conception of what became the Panopticon was of a circular building with an inspection tower in the middle, and he saw it as being suitable for all sorts of institutions like schools, factories, libraries, poor houses and asylums, but it's as a prison that it's best well known. So the prison would have had the cells arranged around the outer wall of the circular prison, and the inspector could sit in the tower.
So the cells are sort of visible inwards. They're facing inwards.
Yeah, so they're opened out to the inspector's view, so the inspector could look into the cells at any time, but the prisoners couldn't see the inspector. So they had to assume that they were always being watched in order to avoid any punishment which might come if they broke the rules of the prison. And Bentham believed that this would make them change their behaviour permanently. And they would cease to commit crimes or misdemeanors and become useful citizens when they were released.
And that prison didn't actually come into being in the end?
No. He spent about a decade trying to get it built, lobbying the British government. And for a while it looked like, on a couple of occasions, it looked like it might actually happen. They gave him a substantial amount of money to buy some land and get ready to build this thing, but for a number of reasons, mostly down to the fact that Britain was transporting convicts to Australia, and being at war with France meant money was tight, and it was actually cheaper to ship people to New South Wales. It's a good thing it wasn't built. I think it would have been a disaster.
Why do you think it would have been a disaster?
Bentham, he seems quite... He sort of viewed prisoners in the abstract. He seemed to think by applying these external impulses, external effects upon prisoners, that he would be able to solve everything. But from researching about penal institutions, there's, as far as I'm aware, there's never been a prison which prisoners couldn't escape from. And the idea of building a prison where all the staff and the administrative block of the prison are surrounded by prisoner cells doesn't strike me as a particularly sensible idea.
Could you have a helipad on the top of the...
or a secret tunnel to run out of?
From the surveiller to the surveyed, we now hear from artist Max Colson, whose work seeks to uncover the control and surveillance that happens at the heart of every modern city.
Working on a project right now for a show in Rotterdam in Holland, and which opens in November, and what I'm working on there is a kind of it's a film and a kind of series of prints of this residential housing estate, which is in a poor part of Rotterdam called Bospolder, and I've become interested in it because it's this gated, well, it's semi-gated, it has its gates closed at night, but there was an actual state. There's a state housing policy in Holland, which is to parachute middle-class professionals into poor areas to bring the areas up. I guess, you know, maybe people spend money, or maybe they bring the schools up, but it turns out lots of people just send their kids to schools outside of the area. Maybe there's a strange idea that the middle class professionals provide like kind of role model kind of figures for the community. But there's the actual estate itself is called Le Medi, which is, and the name, the actual name of the estate was originally going to be called the Medina, because it was set up by this Moroccan businessman, but then through some, I don't know, through politics, maybe focus groups, some kind of research, they decided that a more Mediterranean sounding name and a more Mediterranean style of architecture was more appropriate, and that would attract the kinds of middle class professionals that they wanted.
Okay.
So that there's a clear like relationship between local government and, you know, the needs of, you know, kind of private real estate projects. And I think that's a perfectly, you know, that tension is a perfectly natural thing to happen. I'm not against the states collaborating with the private sector, but I think the tensions that are created there, and like, you know, the ideologies that kind of bubble up in that mix are interesting to explore. I'm not protesting about it. I'm just like showing or like exaggerating the situation.
Okay. But then in other work that I've seen of yours, you actually almost mimic the behaviour of some of the state-private partnerships and the kind of activities that they get up to. So I'm thinking of the plant life and the security surveillance cameras, things like that. Can you talk a bit about those?
Yeah. There's this project I did on the way that plants are involved in security design and kind of privatized public spaces and high security spaces, such as Canary Wharf in London.
Can you please explain that? Because I don't know what.
Well, the project is kind of carried out and is authored by an alter ego that I created. It's called Adam Walker Smith. And he finds out about the way that plants are used to kind of camouflage security apparatus, like kind of CCTV cameras, and you know, instead of having kind of barbed wire fences in some of these environments, you might employ a kind of prickly hedge, because it, you know, it has an aesthetically pleasing quality to it, as well as being a defensive device. But the project is as much about Adam Walker Smith, the photographer's paranoia of plants, because once he finds out about these plants and the way that they're involved in security apparatus, he's kind of unable to look at any plant in these environments as innocent. So the way that it's photographed, it makes the plants appear very creepy and suspicious, and it kind of helps illuminate his problem with identifying his suspect plant life that he's trying to photograph. But that's I was kind of interested there in the dilemma of, I guess, if you're in an environment in which, you know, kind of security and control is very much part of the wallpaper, it's very difficult to actually apprehend, you know, the instances, the correct instances of when control, or like when you might be surveilled, where you might be being surveilled, or and so the kind of, I think the comedy of the project is about, you know, the paranoia of this individual in quite, you know, dealing with quite a controlled space and trying to apprehend, you know, these dodgy kind of bushes and plants. And
I guess that's the dilemma of the theme. You know, if you start to notice things that are hidden in plain sight, then you know something, you think you know something, but it doesn't make you any more effective, I guess. In fact, it almost takes away from your effectiveness to function, because you're so taken over by this paranoia. And I guess once you start looking at these kinds of things, you must start seeing it all the time. And like, maybe that's your Adam Walker Smith character, is kind of your way of dealing with that issue.
I think kind of making creative projects, or making art, or whatever, is a kind of way of acknowledging the limitations of a particular point of view. I think most of the art that I'm interested in is about most art anyway is about subjectivity, and it's about acknowledging subjectivity and the limitations of that subjectivity, and apprehending the experience world, or just the world in front of us. And that to me feels like a much more comfortable position to be in. You know, the kind of world is too big for our you know, it's just everything that goes on, like the system around us, is just too large to really kind of accurately comment on. And so I think kind of creating these fictional characters who have trouble dealing with the controlled urban environment is like my way of, I don't know, just building that acknowledgement into.
Yeah, that's quite nice, because I there are a couple of things that I thought would be interesting to look at. The first is, the purpose of them being there in the first place, control / safety, and that kind of that dynamic. And then the second thing was the capacity for people themselves to kind of utilize these apparatuses themselves. So I've got a friend who is an artist in Philadelphia, and he discovered that he could go online and he could effectively get access to CCTV in America, and he could pick a camera in a location, he could look at what the camera was looking at. So effectively he was utilizing the camera, and he actually made an artwork which his wife really disapproved of, because she thought, you know, this is really sinister. But he swears to God that he found couples who were cheating on one another, you know, who met regularly at certain locations, and he genuinely watch people and the lives that they were leading. And it was, in a way, it was a comment on the fact that he could, and the fact that this CCTV was available to him. And in another way, it was pure voyeurism.
Mm.
And I thought that was quite interesting in relation to your work, because your characters are very, seem to be, well, Adam Walker-Smith seems to be quite upset and paranoid and kind of caught in this bind where he can't, you know, get out. And then there are other opportunities, I guess, where you could almost transcend or utilise the apparatus for your own ends. I was wondering if you'd kind of commented on that at all in your work, or whether you thought about it at all.
To actually become involved in the systems that I'm critiquing
or using.
You
yourself being a photographer, you are, you know, I remember that you played surveillance at one of the kind of interactive artworks in Somerset House, so in a way you do already.
I haven't considered being more performative than, or like kind of actually doing it myself. If you kind of read like a kind of fictional book, my approach is more to just, distill any kind of fears that I have and put it in someone else and turn that into something that, I don't know, can't be confused with myself, because I don't want to authoritatively like say certain things. I haven't found a way. I think humour is quite important to me in my work, and I haven't really found a way to kind of use like actual like kind of surveillance apparatuses. I mean, also I don't have the technical know-how, and there are people out there, like your friends who are, you know, have those kind of skills. So that's something I'd have to learn, but. I find it difficult. I think I'd be too self-conscious to make comedy out of myself. It's much easier making comedy out of other people and their mistakes, but that they're not real. There's another artist whose work I like a lot. He's a kind of young tech whiz, but he produces fantastic work. And he made this installation called Seattle Crime Cams, where the installation in the gallery, it's basically like a series of black boxes linked up to some screens and police scanners in Seattle. And every time when it's installed in the gallery, every time there's a police call on the scanner, the work will find the security cameras that are that stream publicly available information, and it will broadcast the footage from those cameras in the gallery space itself. And I think that's a very controversial piece of work.
But it's interesting because we've talked about the state and the private sector, and we talked about the kind of tension between them, and then people almost becoming part of that work, almost of the design and the built environment. And here you've got the public, an artist or someone, you know, is technically capable of an example of people redefining that relationship almost. So taking over that relationship and using it for their own gain. And that's quite an interesting reversal from that dual system that we were talking about before, where people were just kind of pawns, I guess, in that relationship. It's quite interesting.
I think with that piece of work, it you know, as with your friend's piece of work, it shows it shows people the limitation, or it shows people the extremes to which you can take all of this technology, and you know, just you know, the kind of nightmarish scenarios and the kind of unpredictable scenarios that are created from linking all of these streams of data together. I mean, there's another artist who I really, really like called Renzo Martins, who he does a lot of work in... well, he kind of looks at the role that he, the artist, the camera person, has in the documentation of poverty has, and how his kind of privileged position, how he exploits his privileged position to alleviate suffering of the subjects who he's filming. So one of his projects is called the Institute of Human Activities, and is a kind of conference, but it's also a kind of, you know, they make works of art, they which are produced by artists in the Congo. So for this, the last project he did, there were some sculptures, self-portrait sculptures that were produced by workers in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and he then 3D scanned them and put them in a cloud, and then downloaded them in Belgium, turned them into Belgian chocolate, and then sells them in galleries. And it's only his position as like a white male artist and his brand recognition that allows that to happen. But all of the money goes back to the workers who produced it. Mm. And, you know, he's recreated, he's like literally just shows you like the dynamics of global capitalism and the exploitation of labor. And, but he talks very, you know, he talks about it, he does conferences and lectures, so, you know, like, so there are people out there who are, you know, recreating and utilizing the actual apparatuses of control and kind of the machinations of capitalism.
Our last guest today, Alex Mankiw, tells us what happens when science itself becomes shrouded under the veil of secrecy, and what happens to you as a citizen if you happen to become part of the experiment.
I'm Alex Mankiw. I'm a PhD student here at the Science and Technology Studies Department at UCL. And my research is looking at the history of tear gas technology, and I'm interested in the history of chemical and biological weapons. And I guess that history is full of secrets, dark secrets. And today I understand we're going to be talking about secrecy, Ollie.
Yes.
Well, I have to credit Ulf Schmidt, who's a researcher at Kent University. He wrote a book called Secret Science last year, and in his book he talks about a case study where it shocked me so much that in the margin of a book I wrote "what" in capital letters with lots of exclamation marks. And this case study was a chemical weapons test that happened on the London Underground, and nobody knew that this test happened. And it was in 1963, and Porton Down were basically building their defences, researching defences towards within the biological weapons programme, because biological weapons was a threat to the UK at the time. So one of the primary targets for biological weapons attack would have been transport links and the London Underground. They wanted to find out how far a chemical could travel within the London Underground. So they released a what they believed to be harmless type of spore at the time called something I can't pronounce, Bacillus globigi or something, but let's say Bacillus globigi bacteria, into the ventilation of the London Underground on a day where the London Underground was being used, obviously, by the population of London. And that they found that these spores travelled as far as Camden Town, across the whole of London, following their release into the ventilation system. So this was done in complete secrecy, so that this bacteria is now known to be, that it can have harmful effects, particularly for people with weak immune systems.
Hmm. And did this ever reach the media? Was anyone ever aware of it, other than the small number of researchers involved in it?
Not that I know of. The first time I encountered it was within Ulf's book, and And Ulf has said within his book, he has said that this is an event that was kept under wraps and until, I guess, these files were declassified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he is working on declassified information, but how do you know that you're going to be looking for this information? It's not like you can sort of sit and wait for it to become available if it's something as secret as this.
Yeah, I suppose you raise a good issue for the researcher on secrecy, which is you don't ever really know what you're looking for because it's secret. So it's sort of like instead of looking for a needle in the haystack, I suppose it's kind of like finding the haystack to find the needle in. And often, you know, what I found is you'll find a document that perhaps has a reference in, and that reference is to a secret document. And generally with secrecy, when something's secret, it makes everything that's connected to it secret as well. Mm-hmm. So it's almost impossible to get to it. But, I mean, there's examples of another case. Shall I mention a case?
Yeah.
So, a recent case that I encountered was an article I read about the beginning of the Atomic Energy Agency, International Atomic Energy Agency, by Stephen Twigg, who works at the National Archives. And he, his work, basically, he for his sources, he found a minutes of a meeting that referred to a top secret meeting that happened in Washington that was completely disclosed and under wraps. And the minutes that he found for this meeting had just been declassified, and that was a kind of a way into to him discovering a little bit about how the British felt about the International Atomic Agency and the US proposal of that agency.
And when this happens, does that involve rewriting history when suddenly all this new evidence becomes available that presumably says something that other historians might just have had no chance to think of?
I think what's really interesting is, yeah, I suppose it's rewriting history. I think it offers multiple histories, you know, different readings of history. Something that a traditional experiment might suddenly become something that's that blurs a lot of boundaries. I can mention another case study here if you like, but Brian, who's actually in our department,
Brian Balmer,
he wrote a paper some years ago on an incident where a trawler called the Corella was basically entered a British part of the ocean where the British were performing chemical tests, and they did not know that they had entered this area of the ocean and ended up being trailed by the British British scientists and British Ministry of Defence officials. So they didn't actually know that they were an experiment, and they'd become an experiment. And so, you know, a traditional role of a fisherman and a civilian, they'd suddenly become subjects of an experiment. And the ministry, the army, and the navy nearby had become experimenters. Mm-hmm. And it has an interesting effect, secrecy. I think it produces different ways of looking at a scenario, even for those on the outside of it.
I suppose what I find funny about those two case studies, the underground and the trawler, is you think of both an experiment and secrecy as very controlled, very neat, very organised things. And both of these just sound completely like no one really knew what was going on. And yet somehow they stay under wraps and they produce results that people presumably work from.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose they produce. I think the type of result they produce is unique. I mean, the knowledge that is produced through secrecy, I think, is quite different to the knowledge produced in a lab. You know, because the whole the kind of the rules by which you're operating are completely different.
Citations and...
Exactly. And you're not... Also, you can't really... keeping things secret becomes a big part of your operation. Mm-hmm. So that changes how you even go about your operation. Mm-hmm. And as a result, that will change your methods. It will change your methodology. It will change the knowledge you create. I think it puts a whole level of new constraints on working as a scientist.
Mm. Can you give any examples of that?
Well, I suppose with the Corella example, so with the Corella trawler, there was an option to bring like an antidote to the trawler, the British officials decided not to pursue that because they wanted to see how far they could take the experiment and see, kind of push the boundaries push the boundaries of the effects of what these people have been exposed to. A bacteria or chemical agent would be tested in a laboratory under a completely different set of conditions, but I mean, and controlled conditions that wouldn't harm certain people, that sort of thing. But here with the Corella, there was an opportunity for British science because you had people exposed to this this agent, and there within that there was opportunity to I guess monitor these people as human experiments,
jumping straight to human subjects.
Yeah. I mean, there's a quick and fine line, a quick jump and a fine line. So I think there it is a good example of something where, you know, it just completely changes the methods of a.
So there's some serious ethical questions to be raised here.
I mean, particularly with chemical and biological weapons, because traditional, I guess, experimentation ethics issues would I guess delve into things like just what counts as having informed consent, of giving informed consent. So, you know, Porton Down in the 50s and 60s performed a lot of experiments on humans and on servicemen, and some of those servicemen died in the process. I mean, particularly Ronald Madison's case in the 50s is a well-known case that only went to court in the last 15 years because of secrecy, because it was all under wraps up until then. And a lot of that case rested on determining what informed consent looked like. Did Ronald Madison know what he was being exposed to? Was he aware of the risks in that experiment?
And is that often justified? I know that in some cases, potentially unethical research is justified by appeal to higher values, etc. And in the case of things like biological and chemical warfare, is the idea that this is a military situation or there's potentially greater harm in the future, is that ever employed as a utilitarian argument for carrying out this sort of research, even if it might be ethically dubious?
Certainly, I think the idea of national security and the greater good definitely crops up within these ethical arguments, and within maintaining secrecy, because secrecy is in and of itself a fairly undemocratic thing. I mean, it's obvious that it's a power relationship, and you have people in the know and people who are out of the know, and there is that a separation of kind of the social status.
But in a way that's quite different to some of the ideals of science that say this shouldn't be about separation of people. It should be about the facts, and it should be a communal experience. It shouldn't be that only certain kind of people have access to knowledge. That goes against... Do any of the scientists ever feel that they're doing something that's somehow unscientific by being involved in this?
I mean, yeah, certainly I think there are different ways it can go. I mean, in certain systems, I think the scientists can kind of become, I guess, enrolled in a system in that they believe what they're doing might be right, in the case of, I guess, in the 50s and 60s, because it's upholding national security, and there is also quite a strong culture within some of these institutions, research institutions, but then there's also a whole, I mean, a wealth of, you know, activist scientists out there, you might say, scientists who, I mean, you know, who decided to, like, disrupt these kind of processes and wanted to stand up against them. And so another interesting facet to how people justify, I guess, things like unethical issues, like human experimentation, is secrecy kind of becomes a cause in and of itself. So, like, one, because there is one secret, that keeping that secret a secret becomes an incredibly important thing. So all the, anything else that can connect it, then it kind of, I guess that cause kind of becomes a cause in and of itself, and it gains weight and gains traction as more secrets kind of get pulled into the whole web.
Thank you for listening to The Global Lab. Today's episode was produced by Hannah Sender, Oliver Marsh, and myself, Martin Zoltz-Austwick. Our guests were Max Colton, Alex Mancou, and Tim Causa. If you're interested in the show, or you'd like to listen to back episodes, or suggest guests, or recommend yourself, you can visit our website at thegloballab.com, and we're on Twitter at thegloballab. My Twitter name is sociablephysics, if you'd like to tweet me directly. We'll be back next episode with a brand new set of guests.